Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hotch & Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo. I am your host, Joe Tantillo, and today we have a fantastic and very exciting topic of discussion. It is our very first interview on this show, and it is an interview with Professor Edward Zielinski. So welcome, Professor Zielinski, to the show. We are very happy to have you. We are going to be talking about your exciting history of court cases against New York's convenience of the employer rule, something that we here are very familiar with, and we are just thrilled to be talking with you. So thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I am also joined by a couple of my colleagues from the Hotch & Russ Law Firm. Tim Noonan, who is now a friend of the pod, is here. For those of you who don't know Tim, he is a partner in the state and local tax group at Hotch & Russ. He is the leader of the firm's tax residency practice, and I think this is his now third stint on the show.
Third time's a charm. Happy to be here. Thanks, Joe.
We are also joined by Liz Pascal, who is also a partner of the state and local tax group. Liz, this is her first time on the show. A little bit of background about her. She assists individuals and business clients with New York state and city audits, including residency, sales tax, unincorporated business tax, commercial rent tax, and corporate tax. In addition to her JD from the University of Buffalo, Liz also has a PhD from the University of Michigan. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Also, Liz, former professor, right? So we have two professors in the house. Beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah. And we've only had one air quotes professor on the show before, which is Chris Doyle, who is a professor by nickname only.
Got it. Yes. Okay.
for all the fans out there. And of course, our guest of honor today, Professor Edward Zielinski, who is an American legal scholar and specialist in tax law, working as a professor at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law in New York City. He received his JD and MPhil from Yale University. And he is renowned amongst the tax world for his legal battle against the convenience of the employer rule, which, again, is our topic of discussion for today. So, Ed, again, welcome and thank you. And we are going to dive right into the discussion with a brief overview for our listeners out there of the convenience rule. And for that, I'm just going to flip it to Tim to give us that little introduction.
Okay, great. So the convenience rule applies to non-residents of New York State. If, obviously, as many of our listeners know, if you're a resident of New York, you get taxed on all of your income. If you're a non-resident, you only get taxed on New York sourced income. So that includes wages for services performed. So like compensation for services are taxed to non-residents. And that's usually based on how many days you work in the state. Well, here's where the convenience rule comes into play, because the convenience rule says, well, in counting the number of days worked in the state, you also have to count days where essentially you're working at home for your own convenience and not out of any employer-based necessity. So when you count up your days to determine how much tax you pay in your compensation, the convenience rule again says work-at-home days, telecommuting days, you have to treat those as New York days also. There's exceptions that we can talk about, but that's the basic guts of the rule.
Yes, and it's a rule that on this show I have more than once called unfair, which I'm sure our guest today will have some thoughts and opinions on. So, Ed, before we dive into the meat of the discussion, why don't you tell us just a bit more about yourself beyond the kind of 10,000-foot view that I gave in the intro?
Well, the 10,000-foot intro is absolutely correct. I live in New Haven, Connecticut, where I went to school and stayed and have lived for the last 50 years. I teach at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law, which is in Manhattan. In order to do that, I commute from New Haven when Cardozo has classes 3 days a week. The other 2 days a week, I do my legal research and writing at home, as I do when we don't have classes. There is, of course, the important question that for the COVID period from March 15, 2020, through the following June, Governor Cuomo kept me out of New York all the time by law, and I therefore did all of my teaching on Zoom. I became the poster boy here quite by accident. New York audited me. It's very similar. Someone once said to John Kennedy, how did you become a hero? He said, it's easy. They sunk my boat. How did I become known for this? It's easy. I was audited. I objected. And here I am 20 years later, continuing to fight with New York.
So let's talk about that initial objection. Was it just something that you in the moment felt was wrong? I guess the idea that I'm getting to here is, you know, when did you get the idea to challenge the convenience rule specifically?
Actually, I got it from day one when I started teaching. I've always taught state and local tax. It was very clear to me that there were very serious constitutional problems with the employer convenience doctrine. So for many years, I filed my New York taxes openly, disclosing to New York that while I was prepared to pay taxes on the days I commuted in, I would not pay taxes on the days that I worked at home. And in those days, it was a controversial, but perhaps a less controversial than it is today. And then in 1990, Connecticut instituted its own tax, and that started to create the double tax problem. In those days, the current senator from Connecticut, Dick Blumenthal, was then the attorney general, and he and Gene Gavin, who were the commissioner, occasionally joked that they were hoping New York would audit me because they thought that only a law professor would be crazy enough to take this case to the United States Supreme Court. Well, they got their wish. I received a letter that in 1994, for 1994 and 1995, challenged my New York taxes. And indeed, as these gentlemen wanted, I litigated.
So that's very interesting. I don't think I realized, and I don't know if either of you realized, that you were basically just filing in open defiance of the rule even before you were actually audited, which answers one of my later questions, which essentially was, you know, have you had a problem with the convenience rule from its inception? So can you explain to our listeners then, you know, you've got this initial round of litigation. Can you explain to them the basis for your legal argument in that first go-around?
Yes. In that first go-around, and some of these arguments continue today, the argument is based on the U.S. Constitution. We have what is often called the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is interpreted as a regulation on the state's ability to impose income taxes. We also have the Due Process Clause, which is understood as a regulation on the state's ability to impose taxes. Among other requirements, the United States Supreme Court over a century has said that taxes must be apportioned, that non-residents, as Mr. Noonan indicated, can only be taxed by a state on income they earn within the source, within the state. Apportionment must be reasonable. States could not tax extraterritorially. All of these principles are violated when New York sends a bill into my home here in Connecticut. What could be more extraterritorial than New York taking the position, as they do, that I'm in New York today? I'm not in New York. I'm in Connecticut.
Right. And it is no surprise that the long arm of the New York Tax Department has, you know, attempted to reach its way over the border and into your pocket to take its piece. It's something that we are all too familiar with here. So you lay out your argument for the court, and, you know, they come back with what? What's their basis for rejecting this position?
Well, I guess I'm not a good person to characterize that because I'm hardly objective about it. I think that the Zelensky opinion, as it is titled, issued by the court in 2003, I think it was wrong when it was issued, and I think it's wrong today. And I think there are a whole bunch of things that they say that are wrong, not the least of which, at page 94 of that opinion, the court is very open. We want to tax Zelensky like he was a New York resident. Well, our Constitution has been interpreted to say they can't do it. So in an important sense, today's litigation is saying to the New York courts, you've got to rethink what you decided in 2003. There also are important issues separately for the COVID period when the governor kept me out of New York State. But insofar as I'm raising the issue of 2019 and the pre-COVID year, months of 2020 into March, I am basically saying to the New York courts, you got it wrong in 2003. And even if you think you didn't get it wrong, we're in a different world and precedents have to be reevaluated based on new facts. We live in a different world today than we did in 94 and 95 in terms of things like remote work.
I think that's an excellent point, and no doubt we've experienced a paradigm shift in the society that we all live in that has changed the way that these things should be interpreted. Something I noted in the original opinion is, you know, the court states, and I'm gonna read it verbatim so that I don't misquote it, but that the convenience rule was adopted to prevent abuses arising from, quote, commuters who spent an hour working at home every Saturday and Sunday and then claimed that 2/7 of their work days were non-New York days and that 2/7 of their income was thus non-New York income and either free of tax or subject to a lower rate than New York's. And the court almost alluded to the idea that your case was something similar, that you were this prototypical commuter who was at risk of manipulating your work days in order to pay either a lower rate or allocate less tax to New York. And I think, you know, my question and the point that I'm going to make here is twofold. One, I think it's interesting that to me, the opinion seemed that almost the deck was maybe stacked against you from the start. And did you get that feeling as you were going through the case? And then again, I think this plays to your point that, you know, everything is different now. The prototypical commuter doesn't exist in the same sense that it existed in 1994 and 1995 when the facts of this case were set. When you read that for the first time, what were the thoughts going through your head?
Well, it became clear to me that whoever wrote those words either had not familiarized themselves with the facts of the case or elected not to familiarize themselves with the facts of the case. I very specifically used a 5-day week. And that was clear on its face from anyone who looked at the petition and the tax return. So this notion that I was somehow using a Saturday and Sunday in 1 hour just doesn't apply. I have always filed on the basis of a 5-day week, and I continue to file on the basis of a 5-day week. And in fact, I think I could legitimately file on the basis of a 6-day week. I'm someone for whom Sunday's a working day, but I didn't file on that basis. And I also want to say, as critical as I am of the 2003 opinion, I'm very grateful for Judge Robert Smith, who joined the court after the Zielinski opinion in 2003, and in his dissent in the Huckabee case, went out of his way to say that, in fact, I had complied with the law and behaved honorably. And I'm very grateful to him for making that comment.
Certainly. Tim or Liz, I'm bogarting the mic a little bit here. Do either of you want to jump in with any questions about the first court case at this point? If not, I got a laundry list I keep asking.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, Professor, is do you think it was sort of they were saying, well, you're just a teacher. So, you know, the main thing you do is teach, so that the couple days a week that you're grading papers, like that's really not like what you're getting paid for. Was some of that sort of implied in the court's decision, the first one?
I don't think it's implied. I think it's explicit. The term that the court uses is, quote unquote, ancillary. That legal scholarship is, quote unquote, ancillary for a law professor. Now, there are two problems with that. First of all, everybody knows that's not true, that in the 20th century, law professors do scholarship of equal importance to their teaching. And even more importantly, the facts that were stipulated and before the court stipulated to the contrary. So the court, in making that statement, also had to have ignored the facts as they were stipulated. In the case which is now coming up for 2019 and 2020, New York State, and I give them credit for this, has admitted that that's not true. New York State has admitted that my legal scholarship is of equal importance to my teaching, and I'm going to press the court that that's one of the many reasons they should abandon the 2003 opinion, which uses this term ancillary function, which was wrong then and is certainly wrong now.
It's interesting that I think some of the decisions that have come since then, and, you know, maybe we'll talk a little bit about Huckabee, but even the non-precedential cases kind of go beyond what you're saying the court said is, you know, sort of differentiating between sort of your core duties of, you know, that they thought were teaching versus your research scholarship, everything that you can do from a home office, to say that, look, really what matters is, can you do the work that you're doing at home? Can it be also be performed in the employer's office? In which case, we don't care. We consider that convenience. So it's almost, you know, be interesting to see in the current case whether they kind of dial that back at all, because it seems like all they have done since the original case is to expand the convenience rule in its scope.
Well, it will be interesting because I'm going to emphasize, as I did in the oral argument on April 25th, in my brief, that, of course, we then had the COVID period. And the COVID period is very significant because from March 15, 2020, I did not have a New York office. I was kept out of New York by Governor Cuomo's executive orders. So the application of the employer convenience doctrine for the last 9.5 months of 2020 is on its face wrong. Yes, there are lots of opinions that say if we could have adapted your New York office, you have to pay tax in New York. But from March 15, 2020, Andrew Cuomo said, I can't have a New York office. So it will be important for the court to confront that. You can't say to Professor Zielinski, well, you could have used your New York office, at the same time that Andrew Cuomo has said your use of your New York office would have violated New York public health law. So that will be an important question that I briefly was able to raise on April 25th, but I will raise in great detail in the brief that I'll be filing in June.
Yeah, that's, to me, that's Zielinski part two, right? So that's the second part of the case. But it sounds like, Professor, you have a sort of dual-pronged attack, right? So the first line of argument in your new case that I think you mentioned is for 2019 and 2020, is that right?
2019 and the 2.5 months before the governor's shutdown order. The governor Cardozo started obeying the governor's shutdown order on March 15th. So the facts of 2019 and the first 2.5 months of 2020 very much look like 1994 and 95, with me commuting in to teach and write at home. But the facts for the period that started on March 15th, they're radically different. I was by law forbidden to come to New York. So for New York to say I had a New York office for that period is just wrong. And in fairness, the division has stipulated that I did not have a New York office available to me for that 9.5 months because of the governor's order.
Yeah. And maybe it's a good time to pause. I'd like to sort of discuss that argument in a lot more detail, but maybe just, guys, just to step back a bit. So Professor Zielinski had his 2003, the decision came out by the Court of Appeals, so New York's highest court. I forget, did you try to get to the Supreme Court?
I certainly did apply for cert.
Okay. So they denied cert. So just briefly reset what happened between 2003 and sort of our new case.
Yeah, 20 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, a couple things. First, Professor, you mentioned the Huckabee case. A couple years later, also taxpayer loses. So the tax department upholds the convenience of the employer rule again in another case. The difference being that wasn't a commuter. So, you know, we all thought, well, maybe they'll look at the issue differently if there was a commuter. And I guess they did. At least four or five of the judges in the New York Court of Appeals felt that there was no difference, but there was three dissenting judges, including Robert Smith, who wrote the dissenting opinion. So that was the first thing that happened. And maybe just briefly on that. So, Professor, do you think, I mean, I got the sense, just reading the dissent again today of that decision, do you think that Robert Smith would have ruled differently in your case, or was he making a different distinction because Huckabee wasn't a commuter? He was working for a New York-based company from Nashville. He only came to New York 25% of the time. I mean, it seemed like they were trying to distinguish your case from his case, even the dissenting judges who would have ruled in favor of Huckabee.
Actually, I have a little different interpretation of the Huckabee dissent. First of all, one of the most interesting things, and I'll be emphasizing this in my brief, is that of the three judges who dissented, the two who joined with Judge Smith, two of them were judges who had ruled against me in 2003. That is, Judges George Smith and Carmen Siparek. And I give them a lot of credit also. Judges are not in the habit of saying we're wrong. And the fact that they joined his dissent in toto, I think was a real act of judicial statesmanship on their part. I think it's very clear, although my facts were not in front of the court, I think it's very clear that Judge Huckabee and his dissent indicate that the 2003 decision is wrong. He calls this he says the Court of Appeals has a novel due process and a novel Commerce Clause theory. That's a very polite way of a judge saying a court's made a very bad mistake. So I'm going to be urging the Court of Appeals in my case to look very hard at the Huckabee decision. It's one of the things that I think has eroded the 2003 Zelensky decision. There are many other factors, the changing circumstances. Telecommuting was accelerating even before COVID. The analogy to people working at home and people who stuffed their briefcases to work 1 hour on a Saturday, that analogy was very bad in 2010 and 2012. Today, it's simply crazy. You have the scholarly response. I find it interesting. Professor Hellerstein, who the Court of Appeals has cited itself as an authority in this area, he thinks Zelensky's wrong. So I'm going to urge the court in very strong terms to distinguish Zelensky for the COVID period, but for the pre-COVID period to overrule it.
Got it. Okay. And you mentioned other intervening things since your decision, since Huckabee. Liz, want to chat about a couple of the other things that happened since then?
Yeah, makes sense to mention the TSBM that the tax department put out in 2006, which I think was meant to say, well, look, we understand the result, maybe more of the Huckabee case where you have, you know, the guy sitting in his home office in Tennessee versus Zelensky, you know, just across the border in Connecticut, but saying, okay, we can see that some people might see this as sort of a harsh result for employees who might be working the vast majority of their time from a location far away from New York State and who could easily prove that they're working from that location versus in New York, to say, okay, there might be some circumstances, and this is purely from a tax department policy rather than statutory or regulatory, that the tax department says, look, there might be some very limited circumstances apart from employer necessity where a home office is considered a bona fide office of the employer. But Professor Zelensky, just like you were saying, the facts in or the circumstances in which the initial decision was decided, you know, the facts on the ground have changed so substantially. They have since the 2006 TSBM was issued as well, because basically it carves out certain factors that you can meet to have a bona fide home office, so the convenience rule doesn't apply. But they tend to operate in very limited circumstances. So, for example, if you're a salesperson, keep inventory, you meet customers in your home office. These days, we're talking most people use a phone, a computer, and that's how they do their work. So those sort of carve-outs from the convenience rule really apply in very limited circumstances.
Yeah. Did you ever think, Professor, that maybe you could try to meet sort of that bona fide office safe harbor, or is it just not doable?
No, I think that the 2006 statement is, as we would say in my hometown of Nebraska, my home state of Nebraska, putting lipstick on the pig. It fundamentally did not deal with the basic constitutional principle. The basic constitutional principle is that New York's ability to impose income tax on a non-resident stops at New York's border. And all of these rules that they've created, 15 days, whether I put out a sign on my front porch that says, this is the Cardozo Law School, none of this have a constitutional basis. This is New York making things up to avoid the constitutional rule. The constitutional rule is that states can't tax extraterritorially. And extraterritorial means not in New Jersey, not in Connecticut, not in Tennessee like Mr. Huckabee, not in Arizona like Mr. Kakar. Extraterritorial means anything from 1 mile to 1,000 miles beyond New York's border.
Yeah, it's funny. I sort of think that the lipstick worked for a while in that, you know, from 06 to COVID, I don't recall tons and tons of activity on the convenience rule. I mean, and we, you know, I think we see, you know, hundreds of audits coming through our door every year, right? So we can get a real sense of what the tax department is focusing
right.
on.
And it was more just people who didn't know about the convenience rule and just kind of got surprised that they were treating, you know, days worked at home, just as you did, Professor Zielinski, and got caught unawares. But Tim, I think you're right. We didn't really see a lot having to do with, you know, how that TSBM was applied or people trying to use a safe harbor.
Right, because they didn't like, too, the negative press they were getting. Professor, you mentioned Jean Gavin, Senator Blumenthal, like, There was articles like in the sort of state tax notes about this, and it was sort of a, you know, a state versus state battle. The TSBM, I think, was designed a little bit to take the sting out of the convenience rule in situations where it seemed like a lot of the non-precedential cases, Liz, you mentioned, were sort of going in a ridiculous direction. So yeah, from an enforcement perspective, it was like, wow, was this convenience rule thing sort of dying out? And then COVID, right? And then COVID, and all of a sudden, everyone in America is working remotely, and shoot, you know, now the convenience rule becomes like the hot topic. And it, you know, since March 2020, I mean, us as state tax lawyers talk about the convenience rule every single day. And for the 20 plus years of my practice before COVID, it would come up, but, you know, after the Zielinski and Huckabee cases, it didn't come up a ton.
Right, right. And now you have questions, and this isn't as relevant. Well, it's relevant for the COVID period, but this question of where is your primary office? What does that even mean anymore when people are working primarily remotely?
Yeah. So sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah. No problem at all. I'm
so much for you co-opting the discussion.
Letting the conversation flow. That's what I like to do.
Don't ask lawyers like, hey, can you guys like speak up a bit? Because we won't shut up.
You know, I'm happy to have everybody chime in and get excited about it, because you're right. The convenience rule has kind of consumed our worlds recently. I mean, we give whole presentations on just that as a topic now for an hour and whatever at a time, which it sounds like, you know, the non-convenience rule era predates my time as an attorney, but having been born into the convenience rule as a hot topic era, I can say that I feel like I'm well-versed in a short amount of time. Liz, do you want to talk about the Connecticut rule that basically acquiesced to New York a bit? Because I think that's an interesting development, too, that we should mention.
Yeah, given that Connecticut's your home base, Professor Zielinski, it's worth mentioning that Connecticut in 2019, you know, perhaps realizing that New York was never going to get rid of its convenience rule, and that many Connecticut residents were the ones getting stung by this rule, enacted its own convenience rule, except by statute, except that it only applies if the other state, the state where the employer is located or the, quote, primary office is located, is a state that has a convenience rule. In other words, it passed its convenience rule in the face of New York's convenience rule, which wasn't going anywhere. And I was kind of wondering whether, I mean, obviously that doesn't change the sort of constitutional arguments other than the double taxation issue in the original case.
Well, it's correct that insofar as Connecticut today gives a credit, my damage in my case stems from the fact that New York rates are higher than Connecticut's rates. It's interesting, though, that Connecticut, like myself, were strong supporters of New Hampshire's attempt to get the Supreme Court of the United States to deal with this issue. And so it's very clear from the briefs that Connecticut filed that Connecticut still understands it's losing money. Unfairly, when a state has to give a credit to someone for working in their own state, the state is being taxed unfairly. And so just as I was a strong supporter of New Hampshire's attempt to get the United States Supreme Court to hear the case directly, so was Connecticut.
And is there any like takeaway from what happened there, Professor, that's of relevance to your current case, or not really because the Supreme Court just kind of punted on it?
Well, basically, I decided after the United States Supreme Court's decision to deny cert, that's when I started my refund litigation for 2019 to 2020. I had basically, until that point, taken the position, as you had indicated, that this is not something that the courts were going to resolve. And I was supportive of those members of the Connecticut congressional delegation who filed legislation to deal with this. But I ultimately thought that it would have to be federal legislation or state policy dealing with the issue. What precipitated my 2019 and 2020 refund claims was the brief of the Solicitor General of the United States. When the Solicitor General of the United States said, well, we don't want the court to take New Hampshire against Massachusetts, among other reasons, because this case needs to percolate in the state courts. Frankly, I view myself as the percolatee. So I thought that 03 decision was plenty of percolation. But I said, okay, Solicitor General, you want more percolation? I'm going to percolate. And that's what led me to file the 2019 and 2020 refund claims.
Got it. How big of a deal is it that New York is somewhat of an outlier here? Like that there's only six, if you count Connecticut, six and a half states, we even have a convenience rule. Does that just show New York as an outlier? Does that constitutionally mean anything to I think your constitutional argument, not the sort of COVID office closure argument, like that New York is an outlier?
My own sense is that it doesn't matter whether New York is an outlier. That is, we have some basic constitutional rules. States have boundaries. Boundaries are limits. When New York sends a tax bill to someone in Connecticut or New Jersey or Tennessee, they're violating that limit. And I think the sad reality is that many states are likely to follow. Now, you also have states that understand how incredibly self-destructive this is. I mean, the employer convenience is a sign to New York businesses that says, if you think our tax system is crazy, it's really crazy, go to Florida. And I thought it was very interesting that there was a brief moment when a lawyer in the Arkansas tax department took the position, well, we're going to follow New York and have a convenience of the employer doctrine. Arkansas's legislation immediately reassured the business community, no, that's not our law. You can come to Arkansas without having to pay these crazy New York taxes. So my own view is, yes, it's a self-inflicted wound, which at least some states have avoided, but the constitutionality is fundamental, unconstitutionality is quite fundamental.
Yeah, and I think it's worth sort of highlighting the impact on the business community. I mean, I think we kind of counsel employers all the time in this era of remote work of how are we supposed to address these issues? How are we supposed to hire the best qualified candidates wherever they're sitting because they can do their work forever, knowing that, you know, someone from Texas is not going to be thrilled that if I say, hey, we want you to come to our New York office 1 week a year. And because of that, all of that other time that you spend working at home in Texas is going to be subject to New York tax. And that's, right. you know, from just a business, you know, trying to make the numbers work, trying to hire the best qualified employees, that's really difficult.
Yeah. And oh, by the way, businesses in states without a convenience rule can use it as a perk to people that they're trying to recruit, you know, work for us remotely. And our state isn't going to reach in and tax those remote work days.
Yeah, look, it is. I mean, what we've tried to do using our lipstick again, that use that TSBM to at least try to create these bona fide office arrangements. I mean, we've been doing a lot of that work since COVID to mitigate this as best we can, to at least give us an argument that if you want to hire that great candidate who lives in Florida, doesn't want to pay New York tax, try to do the bona fide home office thing. I mean, I don't, you know, Professor, I don't know that we could do that for you, given the sort of, as Liz said, there's specific factors here. We might not be able to meet them, but we could try. So if you don't win your case, we'll try the bona fide home office arrangement, because that's what we've been trying to do to mitigate the negative effects here in New York.
Right. So I want to bring the conversation, we've kind of danced around it, but I want to bring the conversation fully into the current court case, Zielinski Part 2. Your argument, if I understand correctly, is two-pronged, that the convenience rule cannot apply when your employer's office was forcibly closed down by mandate, and then that the rule itself is unconstitutional is prong two. I want to talk first about that first prong, that the rule cannot apply when the office was shut down by mandate, because I think that is I think that's the more straightforward point here, that it is, you are not working at home for your own convenience when you have literally no office to go to. Will it be a satisfactory result for you? And I think I already know the answer to this, but if the court says, okay, well, we agree with you on that point, but we disagree with the constitutionality. So you win on the X number of months that your office was shut down, but punts or disagrees on the constitutionality question.
Well, the answer is, if that is what the tribunal does, I will say thank you very much and move on to the third department to pursue the constitutional issues for 2019. So yes, I would view it as an important but partial victory if the state of New York recognizes, as I think they should, that as a matter of state law, their own regulations don't let them tax. And it's not simply that their own regulations, we have two regulations that say, first of all, you do not have New York source income when your activities are wholly outside New York. Well, that's precisely the situation I had for 9.5 months. My activities were wholly outside New York because Andrew Cuomo, in effect, said, you're not permitted to come to New York. Second of all, there's a regulation that says, you only have a employer convenience situation when you're working for your convenience. But I wasn't teaching from home for my convenience. I was teaching from home from Cardozo's convenience. Everyone went to Zoom education, not because it was convenient, because the employer needed it. The employers, the law school, would otherwise have been out of business. And then we have lots of case law. The leading decision, of course, is Mr. Foss, who was a New Jersey resident, where the third department said no employer convenience because he didn't have a New York office. Well, you know what? For those 9.5 months, I didn't have a New York office. So, yes, I would consider it an important but partial victory if for the COVID period, the tribunal confirms that as a matter of New York state law, there is no tax due, and that I will continue to press the constitutional claims that I have for 2019.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you, I'm surprised they're even pushing you on that, Professor. I mean, it's galling a bit. I mean, the regulation says it's employer convenience, employee convenience versus employer necessity. Like, this is the dictionary definition of necessity, right? That's why we had all these COVID shutdown orders, because I'm, and we've seen the tax department waffle a little bit and sort of all the, you know, hundreds of audits we've had now on the convenience rule since COVID. But I, I'm glad for you to be challenging it. I'm surprised they're making you, honestly, on that piece.
Do you think part of the reason they're continuing to challenge you on that point is that they are worried that if they drop it or if that's decided in your favor, which actually that should be the bigger concern, that that can be used to say, look, if I, you know, the cases where the employer, right, you no longer actually have office space, right? You might come in and use like a conference room or whatever. And the cases, some of them non-precedential, seem to say, well, the convenience rule could still apply as long as you could do that work. But if the courts decide, okay, you had no office that you could go to, that maybe that will allow for, okay, as long as I don't have designated office space, then perhaps the convenience rule doesn't apply.
I have enough gray hair that I've stopped speculating on what the motivations are on the other side. And I spent enough time as in government to know that you really don't want to speculate about what's going on in governmental processes. I can only deal with the arguments as they have been presented to me. I raised my petition. Like you, I thought there was a good possibility that they would concede on 2020. They chose not to. That's all I know at this point. They have chosen to fight, and they will have to make arguments. I thought it was very interesting that at the April 25th hearing, when the administrative law judge said to New York, how do you defend your position? They said, we're not going to defend it here. Wait for our brief. So we will see in their brief how they defend. I think when you look at the New York regulations, both of them, when you look at the case law, I think it's very hard for them to defend the COVID period. Do they have a plausible argument for the pre-COVID period? Yeah, they can say stare decisis. We think the 2003 Zelensky is still in effect. I understand that. I'm going to have to deal with that. But for the COVID period, I've yet to hear anything other than no. And no is a good argument that I give my three-year-old grandchild, right? Why can't you do that? No, he explained, okay? But I don't think that it's a principled legal argument, and I'm assuming that there will be one in the brief that they are obligated to file in the middle of July.
Let's shift over to the constitutional prong of your argument here. In my interpretation, you've shifted focus a little bit more towards the fair apportionment prong this time around, which I think makes a lot of sense, right? The minimal connection that a commuter or remote worker may have had appears even more eroded given the COVID landscape. Was this your line of thinking behind kind of teeing up that fair apportionment argument?
No, I've always believed and I continue to believe that there are five basic principles that emerge from the relevant case law. One is apportionment. One is the prohibition against extraterritorial taxation. One is the rule about non-residents. One is about the fact that apportionment has to be applied reasonably. And one is that the interstate, Commerce Clause applies to individuals. Now, those rules have always been out there. They're overlapping rules. They're rules that reinforce each other. I raised all of those arguments in 2003, and I'm raising all of those arguments again as to both 2019 and 2020.
And how important is it, though, the changed circumstances with telecommuting being so rampant now? Like, I'm just trying to get a sense of, are you saying, frankly, the 03 decision was wrong, they should just reverse it? Or is it the changed circumstances with telecommuting being so rampant that changes the constitutional analysis? Like, which is it, or is it kind of both?
Actually, it's both. That is, the position I'm going to be taking in the brief is that the 2003 decision was wrong when it was decided. But even if you think it was right when it was decided, it's been eroded by subsequent events. So I'm going to be making both arguments. That's what you do when you litigate. The goal here is to get four judges of the Court of Appeals to say whether Zelensky 03 was right then, it's not right today.
And look, I think we can look to Wayfair, right? Like The Supreme Court in Wayfair, despite the fact that the Quill case was out there from 1992 saying you needed physical presence to require the collection of sales tax, part of it was like, well, the internet happened, right, between 1992 and 2016. So, yes, we respect the 1992 decision in Quill, but circumstances have changed. Like
Right. It allows them to not have to say the original decision was wrong, but only that the facts on the ground have changed so substantially that it allows us to reconsider that decision.
So you can use that in your brief. You don't have to cite us, but you know that's
oh, please cite
us. Yes. Okay. Fine.
And I think that's important to this case in particular, especially on the fair apportionment prong, because the court in 2003 relied so heavily on this idea of, well, the commuters, even if they're teleworking, you know, a couple days a week, they reap the benefits of police and emergency health services and public utilities. And now it's kind of like, well, if I go to New York a couple days a year for, you know, training and a few meetings, am I really reaping? I mean, it's to me, it's tenuous at best, given just the change in remote work that we've seen.
Yeah, I'll tell a short story. So I actually had the pleasure of witnessing the hearing on, was it April 25th, Professor?
Yes.
Why don't you talk about that briefly? It's nothing to do with the merits, but I thought it was fascinating that the Division of Tax Appeals allowed non-parties into the hearing. How did that come about?
Well, it came about because there were several people from the media who asked me if they could cover the hearing. And I assumed that they could. And they then approached the administrative law judge, who said, oh, no, because this is not a judicial proceeding, but is an internal administrative proceeding, a Professor Zielinski's right to privacy controls. And they came back to me and I said, oh, that's an easy one. I'm going to waive my rights. So I communicated with Judge DeFiore and said, I'm waiving my privacy rights. And apparently this is not a common thing. But that's why she then agreed to open the hearing. And I give her credit for doing that. And you may recall she asked me to confirm on the record that I was waiving my privacy rights. And I did, because this is a public process. And I think it ought to be open. I, in fact, as a matter of principle, think that all the hearings before the tribunal and its administrative law judges ought to be public, because they are of a quasi-judicial nature and quasi-judicial proceedings belong to the public. But that's not an argument I have to make right now, because she has accepted my waiver and she let you and others listen. And I was grateful that she did.
We probably have a lot of clients who would not like that. At least, you know, the decisions get published ultimately, but the nuts and bolts and the guts of the hearing don't. But in any case, so because of that, I caught an invite to that as well. And we sat in on it. But Professor, I thought it was very powerful when you said, look at what we're doing today. You were making the point that the world is different than it was in 2003. Who could have imagined we could be holding a Division of Tax Appeals hearing on WebEx or Zoom or whatever it was, with all these boxes on our computer screen? And it's like, yeah, the world has changed in such a brief period of time. No one would have ever thought that.
I promise you that line will be repeated in the brief.
All right. Excellent. No charge again. So.
So, you know, my last big question for you here is, I presume, I guess I should not assume, but I presume that you will fight this all the way to the highest court that you can, if necessary?
I'm hoping I don't have to, but I am prepared. I am hoping that certainly with respect to the state law issues pertaining to 2020, that the tribunal will rule for me as a matter of state law. I want to be realistic. I realize most people don't win in front of the tribunal, but I'm hoping for that. As to the constitutional issues, I'm a realist. I understand that the temptation to accept as a matter of stare decisis the 2003 decision will be strong. And yes, I will press as far as I can, because I think that decision was wrong at the time. And even if you think it wasn't wrong at the time, we're in a different world today. And the New York Court of Appeals, you know, Wayfair is an interesting analogy. The New York Court of Appeals did something very similar, not in the tax area, but in the domestic relations issue, when it in a recent decision, looked back and said, you know, things in the American family aren't the same way they are today that they were 25 years ago. And that, too, is language I will be citing to the court for why they ought to reconsider the 2003 decision.
And were you to bring this to the Supreme Court, I know you said you don't like to speculate, but given the current iteration and makeup of the Supreme Court, do you think that you would find perhaps more success now challenging this at the highest court in the land than perhaps in 2003? I personally think that the current Supreme Court, given the conservative lean, would actually find against the convenience rule.
I'm not sure that this is a liberal or conservative issue, but I do think two things have happened. First of all of us know about remote work. In 2003, you could say Zelensky's lifestyle is crazy, is unique, is something that a law professor can do. No one believes that today. This is a court that held hearings. This is a court that continues to hold hearings on Zoom. Proud father moment, the special master in the Delaware case who held a hearing for the Supreme Court on Zoom. It was my son who argued that case on Zoom while for the state of Delaware. One of life's great ironies. But yes, the judges know about remote work, and they can't say what the court said in 2003, this is a crazy world. The other thing that has happened that I think is very important is the New Hampshire petition. Yes, it was denied. But if you believe that litigation is a process of educating judges, I think that was a very important episode. And I keep telling my friends in New Hampshire that they should, while they didn't get an immediate victory, they did, in fact, I think, one of the reasons that Massachusetts abandoned the convenience rule and went back to its prior rule with COVID, I think was because of their brief, but I think their brief also was part of the process of educating the court. So if it got to the Supreme Court today, I would hope that because of the changed circumstances and because of the trailblazing that New Hampshire did, I would hope that there would be four votes for cert.
Terrific. Well, I think that is an excellent point to bring this conversation to a close on, unless any of the guests have any parting thoughts.
I don't have a parting thought. I'm just interested, Professor, like, has this come up in your class a lot? Like, just is this a teachable moment for you and your students? Because you are a state tax professor as well. So,
oh, yes, this is a good moment for a student to be taking state and local tax for me. One of the exercises they will be doing is mooting. I have been blessed with a lot of good help from a lot of people who have helped me, including my Cardozo colleagues, including the other folks who teach state and local tax. And yes, my students will be mooting me. So yes, this will be an important part of their education.
And if the Supreme Court does grant cert, will you argue the case?
Oh, yes.
Excellent.
You should have your son do it. He's a veteran.
See, I have two sons who litigate in front of the highest courts, but I think they will be mooters. Maybe they'll be second chair, but I think dad should be the first chair.
Fair enough.
Well, terrific. Well, Professor, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. This was really an exceptional discussion, and we were thrilled and I think got to, you know, even nerd out a little bit on this topic, and it was awesome to hear some of the history and the background, not only of the previous case, but of the current case from your mouth directly. And we certainly look forward to seeing how this all resolves. And, you know, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you to all the listeners out there. This has been State Tax Talks. I am Joe Tantillo. We will see you next time. Thanks for joining us for another episode of State Tax Talks. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans.